Imagine a legal loophole where the government actually lets you pretend your, perfectly good appreciating house is slowly falling apart, and they give you a massive tax break for it for exactly 27.5 years.
It sounds totally made up, but it is very real.
Right. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. It is Monday, April 13th, 2026, and today we are looking at wealth building through a distinctly, I guess, mechanical lens. Specifically, we have this really fascinating source material on our desk.
Yeah, strategic blueprints for real estate investment success.
Exactly. And it's heavily backed by real-time data from the Osul Gamma investment platform.
And, I have to say, it's a phenomenal blueprint because it completely strips away the romanticism.
Oh, totally.
Because there's this pervasive idea online, you see it everywhere, that property is just this magical money printing machine. Like you buy a house, you sit back, and you just get rich.
Just collect checks on a beach somewhere.
Yeah. Right. But the fundamental premise established right at the beginning of our research is that while going into this without a highly specific plan and without continuous management is incredibly costly, success here is entirely dependent on aligning your personal financial goals, your specific investment timeline, and your actual tolerance for risk.
And that is our mission for today. We really want to cut through the overwhelming noise of online financial advice and help you, the listener, map out a customized strategy. Whether you want to get your hands dirty with a sledgehammer on the weekends or just generate completely passive income without ever even looking at a tenant,
Right.
you need to figure out exactly where you fit on that risk-return spectrum. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start with deciding how you want to make your money.
Which is the fun part.
Exactly. And the blueprint lays this out by moving along a spectrum, right? From the most hands-off approaches all the way to the heavy sweat equity strategies. And the easiest entry point they mention is REITs, real estate investment trusts.
Yeah, REITs are a great starting point.
But I mean, how is buying a REIT any different than just, buying a standard tech stock on Robinhood?
Well, the difference is entirely in the underlying asset and really the mandatory structure of the company. A REIT is a company that owns, operates, or finances income-producing real estate.
So, like, what kind of real estate?
Think massive apartment complexes, data centers, or huge shopping malls. When you buy a share, which by the way trades exactly like a regular stock, you are buying a tiny sliver of that physical portfolio.
Okay, got it.
But the real mechanism that makes REITs unique is that legally they are required to distribute at least 90% of their taxable income back to shareholders as dividends.
Wait, 90%
Yep.
legally.
Legally, yes.
So you get the passive income of rent collection without having to like fix a leaky roof at 2 in the morning.
Exactly. You are minimizing your risk by pooling your money with thousands of other investors.
Right.
I mean, if you only have $1,000 to invest, you obviously can't buy a commercial warehouse.
No, definitely not.
But you can buy $1,000 worth of a REIT that owns 50 warehouses across the country. And it is perfectly liquid. Like, you can sell your shares on a Tuesday afternoon if you suddenly need the cash.
Which is perfect for the totally silent investor.
Yeah.
But let's say you actually want your name on a physical deed. The next step up the ladder is the classic buy and hold.
Ah, yes. The traditional wealth builder.
Right, buying a property in a developing suburb and just, renting it out for a decade. But I want to zero in on the vulnerability here because the research emphasizes that this suffers from illiquidity.
Right.
For someone just getting into this, what does illiquidity actually mean in practice?
It simply means you cannot easily or quickly convert the asset back into cash. I mean, if you own a tech stock and your car breaks down, you just sell a few shares instantly to pay the mechanic.
Click a button on your phone.
Exactly. You can't do that with a house. You cannot slice off a piece of the roof and sell it to buy groceries. If you need your capital back, you have to list the property, find a buyer, wait for their mortgage to clear underwriting.
Pay closing costs.
Yes, pay commissions. It takes months. So the buy and hold strategy really requires locking your money away to leverage the compounding nature of real estate over a long period.
But what if you don't want to wait a decade to see a serious return? Because that brings us to the third approach, which is short-term rentals, essentially the Airbnb model.
Yeah, the hospitality side of real estate.
Right. Now, the source material claims that if you are in a tourist-friendly city, this can be highly profitable with minimal upfront capital. But I have to stop here because I am highly skeptical of that easy money narrative.
A lot of people are.
I mean, if you are relying on peak season tourists who expect a fully furnished, pristine boutique hotel experience, doesn't that inherently make it much riskier than just locking in a reliable, boring tenant for 10 years?
Well,
Because you're incredibly sensitive to economic shifts, right? If a recession hits, vacations are the very first thing families cut from their budget.
You're completely right to be skeptical of the easy money narrative, but don't discount the actual margins being generated here. I mean, if you have the right location, say a charming cabin near a popular national park, that property can gross in 1 week what a traditional long-term lease generates in an entire month.
Wow. In 1 week.
Yeah. The revenue ceiling is undeniably higher. But what's fascinating here is how the blueprint explicitly maps out the mechanical trade-offs. You're absolutely right about the risk.
Right.
Short-term rentals yield fast cash flow, but they demand active, constant involvement. You are essentially buying a second job in the hospitality industry.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You are managing cleanings, responding to guest complaints at midnight, constantly tweaking dynamic pricing algorithms.
So it's a trade-off. You are trading your personal time and economic stability for hyper-accelerated cash flow. Now, for the people who look at a crumbling, distressed property and see dollar signs, we move to the fourth strategy, fix and flip.
The TV show special.
Exactly. This is where you purchase an undervalued property, renovate it, and sell it for a profit as quickly as possible.
And it is highly aggressive. The margin for error is razor thin. The data actually shows that successful flippers aren't just, you know, good with a hammer. They are obsessed with hyper-local data.
What do you mean by that?
They know exact renovation costs down to the penny. And more importantly, they understand neighborhood caps.
Okay, neighborhood caps.
Yeah. If the most expensive house in a neighborhood just sold for $300,000, it doesn't matter if you put $100,000 worth of Italian marble into your flip.
Oh, I see.
The local market simply won't support a $400,000 price tag. You will lose money.
Which perfectly sets up the final and definitely the most complex strategy in our blueprint.
Yes.
The BRRRR method. Buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat.
Yes.
To me, this sounds like a highly lucrative real estate recycling program. But can you walk us through the actual mechanics of how this works? Like, how do you keep buying houses without running out of cash?
Okay, let's use some simple math to explain the mechanism because it's brilliant. Imagine you find a distressed, unlivable house for $100,000.
Okay.
You buy it in cash. You then spend $50,000 fixing it up, new kitchen, new floors, fixing the foundation. You are all in for $150,000.
Got it.
Because it's now a beautiful, modern home, you place a reliable tenant in it who pays you monthly rent.
Okay. So I have a rental property, but my bank account is completely empty. I spent all my cash.
Right. But here is the magic of the refinance step. You go to a bank and say, I own this house free and clear, and I want a mortgage on it.
Even though I just paid cash for it.
Exactly. The bank sends out an appraiser. And because of your smart renovations, the appraiser says the house is now worth $200,000.
Oh, wow.
So the bank agrees to give you a cash-out refinance loan for 75% of that new value.
And 75% of $200,000 is $150,000.
Exactly.
Wait, so the bank just hands you a check for $150,000?
They do. You pull out your original investment capital, every single penny you spent buying and fixing the house. But you still own the house.
That's crazy.
The tenant's monthly rent pays the new mortgage you just took out, and you take that stack of $150,000 and basically toss it right into the next messy house.
You're just recycling the exact same money.
You are creating equity out of thin air through renovations, and then liquidating that equity to fund your expansion.
That is brilliant, but it clearly bridges the gap between active and passive.
Yeah.
Right? Because you have to be deeply involved in the messy rehab phase to earn the right to the passive rent phase.
Exactly.
Okay, so you have picked your lane on this spectrum. Here's where it gets really interesting. Once you have your vehicle, how do you press the gas pedal?
Right, the multiplier effect.
Yes. Because outperforming the average investor requires highly intentional mechanics. The first multiplier the blueprint outlines is leverage smartly.
And leverage is the core engine of real estate wealth. It simply means using borrowed capital to amplify your return. The blueprint provides a stark mathematical contrast here.
Walk us through it.
Imagine you have $400,000 in cash. You could take all of that money and buy one property outright. You own it free and clear, and you collect rent.
Which feels safe. No mortgage hanging over your head. I can sleep at night.
It feels very safe. But inflation is constantly eating away at the purchasing power of that rental income. The smart leverage approach suggests using that same $400,000 to make a 25% down payment on three different properties.
Okay.
Financing the rest through bank mortgages. So suddenly, instead of controlling $400,000 worth of real estate, you control over $1.2 million worth of assets.
Right.
You are capturing the appreciation and the tax benefits on three houses instead of just one.
Hold on, I need to push back hard on this.
Right.
Putting 25% down on three different mortgages instead of owning one house free and clear. That sounds like multiplying your debt and your anxiety by a factor of three. I mean, if a major local employer shuts down and all three of your properties go vacant in the exact same month, you are on the hook for three massive loans.
That is a very real fear.
You could lose everything. Is that actually smart, or is it just reckless gambling?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, your concern is exactly why leverage is so dangerous in isolation. If you leverage randomly, you absolutely gambling.
Right.
But the leverage only works and avoids becoming the nightmare scenario you just described if you apply the second multiplier, investing in high growth markets. You don't buy three properties just anywhere.
Oh, I see.
You buy where the data guarantees demand.
And this is where the Osol Gamma platform data comes into play. Mm-hmm. Because they aren't just, you know, looking at Zillow estimates. How are they actually identifying these safe markets?
Well, they are looking at the underlying economic mechanics before the housing market even reacts.
Like?
They are scraping municipal data for newly approved highway off-ramps, tracking corporate building permits to see where major tech companies are relocating.
Oh, wow.
They're analyzing demographic migration patterns. And the data specifically points to up-and-coming suburban cities offering a vastly better return on investment than saturated, expensive urban cores.
So getting ahead of the curve.
Exactly. If you know a massive hospital complex is being built 3 miles away in a suburb, you know thousands of nurses and doctors are going to need housing there over the next decade. That data is your shield against the vacancy risk you mentioned.
Okay, so data-backed leverage is the engine. The third multiplier is using tax advantages. And the research mentions something called a 1031 exchange. And of course, that 27.5-year depreciation loophole I mentioned at the very beginning of the deep dive.
Yes, the tax code is heavily favored toward real estate investors.
Let's translate these for someone driving right now. What exactly is a 1031 exchange?
Think of the 1031 exchange as a legal pause button on your taxes.
A pause button.
Right. Normally, if you buy a house for $100,000 and sell it years later for $300,000, the IRS is going to demand a massive cut of that $200,000 profit through capital gains taxes.
Which hurts.
It hurts a lot. But Section 1031 of the tax code says that if you take those profits and immediately reinvest them into a like-kind property, say, selling a duplex and buying a larger apartment building, you pay zero taxes on the sale.
Wait, zero?
Zero. You roll your entire profit into the next asset. You can keep doing this until you die, constantly upgrading your portfolio without ever losing a percentage to the IRS along the way.
It's literally like playing Monopoly and upgrading your greenhouses to a red hotel without paying a fee to the bank.
That is the perfect analogy.
And what about the depreciation? Why exactly 27.5 years? That's so specific.
It is. The IRS recognizes that physical buildings deteriorate, right? Roofs cave in, pipes rust, foundations settle. So they calculated that the average useful lifespan of a residential structure is exactly 27.5 years.
Right.
The mechanic here is incredible. Let's say the physical building you bought, not the land, just the structure, is valued at $275,000.
Right.
The IRS lets you divide that by 27.5, which gives you $10,000. That means every single year, you get to claim a $10,000 loss on your taxes due to physical wear and tear.
But wait, even if the actual market value of the house is going up?
Precisely. It's a phantom deduction. You didn't actually spend $10,000 in cash fixing anything.
Right.
But you get to subtract $10,000 from the rental income you collected when you report to the IRS. It aggressively shields your cash flow from income tax.
That is a staggering advantage. And I guess it leads right into the fourth multiplier. Adding value strategically. If the IRS assumes the house is degrading, your job is to ensure it's actually improving.
Right, but we aren't talking about gutting a house down to the studs here.
What are we talking about then?
Strategic value add is about the highest return on minimal capital injection. The research points out that simple upgrades, a fresh coat of modern paint, swapping out dated brass cabinet hardware for matte black.
Oh, the aesthetic stuff.
Exactly. Installing resilient luxury vinyl plank flooring, these things can disproportionately increase the monthly rent you command. If you spend $5,000 on cosmetic updates, and it allows you to increase rent by $200 a month.
Yeah.
That increases the overall valuation of the property by tens of thousands of dollars if you go to refinance it.
Wow. And the final gas pedal strategy is utilizing property management. Hiring a manager usually costs, what, around 8 to 10% of your monthly rent?
Roughly, yes.
That actively cuts into your cash flow. But the blueprint argues it's a necessary multiplier.
Because it shifts your role from a tired landlord to a true investor. A property manager acts as your shield. They take the 2 a.m. plumbing calls.
Which nobody wants.
Nobody. But more importantly, they understand the exact legal requirements for eviction notices in your specific county. They enforce the lease ruthlessly, and they preserve the physical asset by conducting routine inspections. They buy back your time so you can focus on finding the next property.
Okay, so we've got our strategy. We've pressed the gas pedal with leverage, data, and tax hacks. But since we established that leverage inherently multiplies our risk, how do we build an emergency brake system?
You definitely need one.
Right. If we don't want to crash and burn, what are the guardrails the source demands?
The first and most critical is relentless due diligence before you ever sign a contract. You cannot rely on a real estate agent's sunny disposition.
No.
You must run your own rental comps, which means looking at what comparable properties on that exact same street actually signed leases for last month, not what Zillow estimates they might rent for.
That's a huge difference.
Massive. You need to investigate the school districts, the crime heat maps, and the structural integrity of the house.
So, absolutely no guessing allowed. Guardrail number two is maintaining adequate reserves. And the blueprint dictates you absolutely must have 3 to 6 months of operating expenses sitting in a liquid cash account.
Yes.
This speaks directly to my earlier anxiety about, you know, three furnaces breaking at once.
This is exactly where over-leveraged amateurs wipe out. They use every last dollar of their capital to acquire the properties, leaving literally nothing for operations.
Right.
If a tenant stops paying rent and it takes 3 months to legally evict them, the mortgage company still expects their check on the first of the month. If you don't have cash reserves, your entire leveraged empire starts to collapse like dominoes.
Which makes Guardrail 3 incredibly obvious. Vet tenants thoroughly.
Yeah.
Because even with cash reserves, a bad tenant can drain your accounts in weeks with property damage or unpaid rent.
Oh, absolutely.
You have to verify payslips, run background checks, and honestly, call their previous landlords.
The data is definitive on this. The cost of a vacancy is always lower than the cost of a bad tenant.
Better empty than ruined. Guardrail 4 is insuring your investment. You aren't just getting standard homeowners insurance. You need specific landlord liability coverage. I mean, if someone slips on the icy driveway of your rental property, you need a massive umbrella policy so a lawsuit doesn't target your personal savings.
That's crucial.
And that brings us to the ultimate guardrail, diversification. The text breaks this down into four pillars: geographical, property type, strategy, and passive versus active.
Which means you are building structural, engineered resilience into your wealth.
I look at these four pillars of diversification kind of like a balanced diet. You can't just eat residential flip protein every single day.
No, you can't.
You need some boring REIT vegetables to survive a major market shift. You need a mix of geographic locations and property types so one local disaster doesn't wipe you out. So what does this all mean?
This raises an important question about human psychology. Investors, by nature, constantly chase the glamorous adrenaline-pumping strategies.
Of course they do.
They want the dramatic fix and flip they can brag about at a dinner party. They want the massive immediate cash flow of an oceanfront short-term rental.
Okay.
But what the data fundamentally proves is that, true, generational wealth is preserved through incredibly boring administrative discipline. It is preserved by having the emotional control to let $40,000 sit idly in a 6-month reserve account earning basic interest.
That's so hard for people to do.
It is. It is preserved by having the patience to read through a mundane 40-page tenant background check. The glamour builds the wealth, but the boredom protects it.
That is such a crucial takeaway. Real estate in 2026 is clearly not a one-size-fits-all lottery ticket.
Not at all.
It is a highly customizable menu. Success requires you to ruthlessly align your personal life and risk tolerance with the right vehicle. You have to fuel it with smart leverage, leverage Osol Gamma's data to find the growth, utilize tax hacks like that 27.5-year depreciation, and force appreciation with strategic upgrades. And then you have to protect the entire system with absolute due diligence and a balanced diet of diversified assets.
It requires ongoing education, adaptability, and emotional detachment. But if you execute the mechanics of this blueprint, it remains an unparalleled engine for financial independence.
Absolutely. Now, before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. The source material we cover today focuses entirely on the tangible mechanics, financial returns, risk tolerance, investment timelines.
Right.
But think about the psychological side of this. Once you start viewing properties through the lens of the BRRRR method, or 27.5-year depreciation or strategic value add, it permanently changes how you see the world.
It really does.
Every single neighborhood you drive through, every fresh coat of paint you see on a neighbor's house, suddenly stops being just a house and looks like a line item on a balance sheet. Are you ready for that permanent shift in how you view the very spaces we live in? Something to think about the next time you walk through your own front door. Thank you so much for joining us for today's deep dive. Keep questioning, keep exploring, and we will catch you next time.